Hello?
Colin.
Hey, John. I'm in a bit of a construction zone, just so you know, so it's a little bit noisy.
Okay. Have you got time?
Yeah, of course. No, put aside the time.
Awesome.
I don't know if you can hear the noise behind.
No, I can't at all. It's really clear.
Oh, okay, great.
How are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
Not too bad. It's been a little while.
I know. It's been too long.
Yeah.
How's the family?
Everybody's doing real well. In fact, before I forget, my wife told me on the way out the door to thank you for your, as usual, your generous donation to Luciano and Annabella's fundraiser.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And it's great that they're doing it. They look so cute. I was out in Colorado with John Michael, leaving him off there. That was quite an interesting... an interesting time. So, can you believe Johnny Michael is in college now?
Oh my gosh, I can't believe that. Where is he going to school?
Colorado College.
Colorado College. What city is that?
In Colorado Springs.
Ah, okay. Oh, that's awesome. So that's why you were out there.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So that's a good place for him to be with his biking, though.
Exactly. And he's become a bit of a hippie too. So.
Is that right?
So it really is. It's absolutely perfect for him.
That's fantastic.
Perfect for him.
Is Isabella finished by now, or no? She's still.
She's going into her third year.
Okay, that's fantastic. Wow, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, she's into politics now.
Oh,
changing the world.
That's fantastic. Well, we've got about 22 students here who are about to enter into college next fall. Yeah, and they're anxious to talk to you a little bit. We got enough questions that we could probably, we won't keep you past 30 minutes. But we appreciate you talking to us very much. They've read a few short stories and a little bit from the new book. Some of the questions are based on the new book, which I saw you thank John.
Oh, yeah?
I saw you thank John Michael in that, so he must have had a hand in the new book.
Yeah, well, he's become my reader, ever since my father passed away. He's been reading my stuff for me, so...
That's fantastic. Wow.
I know. It's kind of wild, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's great.
I've been working away, and I'm sort of early on in the new novel, but it's a big one, John, a real big one. So
really?
It's going to take me a long time.
So is this a new idea? Is this a whole new idea you've come up with for the new novel?
A whole new geography, a whole new idea.
Can you say anything about it?
well, I've been traveling a lot to Israel and Palestine. So
that's the basis.
That's kind of what it's about. So if you hear any water noises, me making coffee.
Okay.
Let's know.
All right, sounds great.
So how are those students? Are they really good?
Yes, they're fantastic. They really are. This has been the year's off to a great start with these guys, and they've really had great conversations about your work so far. We've had some really interesting discussions. So, say hello, everybody.
Hi.
You know they're here.
Hey guys, how are you doing? I'm on speakerphone. Am I?
What's that?
Am I on speakerphone?
Yeah, you're on speakerphone. Got a big conference phone here. They could all hear you. Old fashioned, the old fashioned.
Any of them looking at Colorado College as a place to go?
Is anybody?
I looked into it once. And
you did?
I found me that lived there. So.
Okay.
Miss Drennan went there.
Oh, Miss Drennan. Wait, they said we had a teacher, Miss Drennan, another English teacher went there, and one student, Deontay, said that he has looked into it because he's got family out there. That's a beautiful place.
Right.
That's a beautiful place. My brother used to live in Fort Collins, and I was out there a few times, but I hadn't been to that college. I think CSU was there. I'm going to turn it over to Bailey, who's going to ask you the first question. If you guys want to tell me your major, just as a way of introduction, but here's Bailey.
All right.
Hello.
Hey, Bailey, how are you?
Good, how are you? I'm in creative.
Very well.
I'm in creative writing here, by the way, but...
Mm-hmm.
So my question was, in Letters to a Young Writer... You write, "Do not be afraid of sentiment, even when others call it sentimentality." I was wondering how you avoid being cliche or like melodramatic when you're writing emotionally powerful fiction.
I think it's basically the equivalent of walking a tightrope, because, I mean, the fact of the matter is that you want to say something, and when you want to say something, you have to be passionate, and you don't want to temper yourself too much, and you don't want to censor yourself too much. And basically, what you have to do in certain ways is write to the very edge, walk the tightrope as much as you can, with the knowledge that if you look back on this piece a year from now or 5 years from now, is it going to make you blush? Or and you basically ask yourself, is it saying too much? If it's saying too much, then dial it back. If it's saying too little, then you got to dial it up again. But it's a very, 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 very difficult thing to do. And anybody who wears their heart on their sleeve, be it like someone like Jim Harrison or Toni Morrison or, any number of writers, anyone who wears their heart on their sleeve sort of risks themselves. But you have to risk yourself. And you have to sort of dare to push it towards the edge. And sometimes it may be even better to say too much than to say too little and then get back in afterwards with your editing pen. So, I think that's does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, thank you, and good luck.
Brianna is asking the next question.
All right.
Hi.
Hi, Brianna, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, how are you?
Good. And did very well.
So my question is about your Let the Great World Spin. So your novel was deeply influenced by the tightrope walker between the towers. Were there any other angles that you considered taking to express your reaction to 9/11 before you settled on his walk?
Yeah, well, I mean, in writing about 9/11, I wrote some essays for Irish newspapers. I wrote a little essay for the New Yorker magazine. The essays for Irish newspapers was more or less about my family and my family's reaction, and my father-in-law being in the first building to be hit, the second building to come down. He survived. And then another article for the New Yorker was basically just a very little piece about watching a woman the night after the World Trade Center bombing, the World Trade Center after 9/11, watching her out on the street in a restaurant, and she ordered and ate a piece of chocolate cake. And I know that sounds very mundane, but it wasn't mundane at all to me, and it was kind of amazing. And I just wondered what was going through her head. And maybe John will give you access to that piece. You can have a look at it. So there was a lot of things that I wanted to say about 9/11, a lot of ways I wanted to say it. But the only novel that I wanted to write was the novel that I have written. So the only way I wanted to write about it in a larger piece of fiction was through the title of the book.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Patrick has the next question.
Patrick? How are you, Patrick?
I'm well, how about yourself?
Good. How did you get a Polish name like Patrick?
So my question is, in a conversation that we had with B.H. Fairchild last Friday, he told us that he's working on a poem based on the final paragraph of the James Joyce story, The Dead. And in letters to a young writer, your section titled Rejoice urges young writers to simply read Joyce. So I was wondering, what do you consider to be Joyce's greatest contribution to readers and writers?
Ooh. The fact that he still has people asking questions like you're asking, the best part of 100 years later, that he was so up-to-date, so contemporary, so aware that he was sort of changing things and pushing things, experimenting, asking difficult questions, and leaving us conundrums like Ulysses, and even more so fitting his way, and then leaving us also these beautiful stories like The Dead, which is
one of the absolute classics. It may be the greatest short story ever. And that paragraph that he's talking about, you know, amongst the living and the dead, and, you know, snow was generaled all over Ireland, that's one of the most famous paragraphs and most quoted paragraphs in English, Irish, you know, English-speaking literature. You know, to have written one thing, W.B. Yeats says, before I am old, I shall have written him one poem, maybe as cold and as passionate as the dawn. So to write one thing that gets remembered is pretty incredible. To write many, many things that get remembered and still engage people of all ages is it's kind of wonderful. So I hope you do it too. When you do your writing, write something memorable.
Thank you. Taylor has the next question.
All right.
Hi, Professor McCann. My name's Taylor.
Hi, Taylor.
I'm also a creative writing major here. I'm doing well. How are you?
Great, thanks.
So I wanted to ask you about your work with Narrative 4.
Cool.
So your work with Narrative 4 is centered on your idea of radical empathy and stems from the idea that stories are powerful agents of social change. And in your novel, Let the Great World Spin, you explore the lives of intersecting characters who take turns telling the reader their own story. What extent did each of these projects inform the other? Was it your writing that sparked your perception of radical empathy, or was it that perspective which brought you to write in the first place?
Well, that's a great question. And it really goes to the heart of so much of that what I care about. I mean, I really care about Narrative 4 deeply. And in fact, I've always thought that somehow we should engage with you guys down there and start some sort of Narrative 4 chapter in the school, because more than ever, we need something like Narrative 4, which, as you know, is about the exchange of stories. You step into my shoes, I step into yours. For me, the question is really good, because they're both sort of a natural extension of each other. Let the Great World Spin first. But it was a natural step then into Let the Great World Spin. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that one of the employees that we have in Narrative 4, named Lee Keelup, who was a high school teacher in Newtown, Connecticut, where Sandy Hook occurred. And I think you guys probably remember the massacres that occurred in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, and when 26 people were killed four and a half years ago now. He used the Narrative 4 method in the school and invited me up to his school to talk about Let the Great World Spin right at the conjunction of the two things. So he later left the school and became our global program director, because he knows how well it works. So in my imagination, the two things, Let the Great World Spin and Narrative 4, are sort of intimately fused. But the Great World Spin came first, but it really led into Narrative 4. And in a curious way, almost retroactively, or almost like going backwards in time, Narrative 4 now makes more sense of Let the Great World Spin for me.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. That's a great answer. Thank you. Thank you. Zoe will be asking you the next question.
Thank you.
Hi, Professor McCann.
Hi, Zoe. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
So my question is, how much consideration do you give to the point of view in which your stories are told? Because I noticed in Let the Great World Spin, Kieran spoke in first person and Claire's story was delivered in third person.
Right. Oh, it's so important to figure out who's telling the story and why they're telling the story. And that will dictate the point of view. In fact, the who, what, where, when, how, and why often dictate the point of view. But essentially, you have to ask yourself, who is telling the story and why do they want to tell the story, and where are they telling it from? And if it's first person, you have to absolutely know the answers to all of those. If it's third person, it's a little different. Now, and what you pinpoint so rightly is that, I go from first to third, but Claire's chapter is a curious meld of third and first person. So she does things like, I say things like, she walks towards the curtain, and then you're in her head, she thinks, light wall, these are nice curtains, or whatever it happens to be. So it sort of, it operates between third and first, and actually uses a little bit of both as they go along. But it's that's a delicate balancing act to be able to do both at the same time. And then, of course, the second person, which I very seldom use, which is, you walk down the street, you do this, or we do walk down the street. But it's very, very important to figure out who's telling the story and, what perspective you want them to tell it from. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
It's a good writer's question. Thank you.
All right, McCormick's asking the next question.
Okay.
Hello, Professor McCann.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well, and I'm hoping you're doing well as well.
I am, thank you.
So, in your author's note for Let the Great World Spin, you write, there are still so many stories to be told. I recall a quote from Willa Cather saying, there are only two or three human stories, and they go on repeating themselves as fiercely as if they never happened before. So what are your thoughts on the philosophy of literature, and are there any new stories to be told?
Well, that's a good question, too. You guys are keeping me on my toes this morning. I'm not so sure that I agree that there are only, two or three types of stories, that I can understand somebody saying that, and I can understand the way that you can sort of box certain stories off, and certain ones be about betrayal, certain ones be about journey, certain ones, be about particular large issues. You might be able to say there's only one human story, and that's what Bulmer said was the human heart in conflict with itself. But for me personally, I think there are endless numbers of stories. There are limitless amounts of stories. And the new novel that I'm working on has a title that is a paragon, A-P-E-I-R-O-G-O-N. I'm pretty certain that nobody in the class knows what that word means. I think if they do, I'd be very, very surprised, because I didn't know it. I've only ever met one person who knows what it means. A paragon is a shape with a countably infinite number of sides. A polygon, a hexagon, so on. And a paragon is a shape, weirdly, with an infinite number of sides. Isn't that funky?
Yeah.
And that's what I think storytelling is. I think storytelling is an paragon, a constantly evolving shape. So in certain ways, it's one thing, right? And it's everything also at the same time. So that would be part of my philosophy of literature and storytelling. And it gives me great hope to think that it's constantly changing, constantly in a flux. If I thought that I could put manners on it and keep it down to a number of different thematic sort of stories, it would depress me a little bit, yeah. So I like the fact that it's infinite.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Courtney will be giving the next question.
Thank you.
Hi, Professor McCann. I'm Courtney.
Hi, Courtney. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. Okay. So, based on the short stories we've been reading in class so far, like Everything in This Country Must and Fishing the Slow Black River, your short fiction tends to have both like a literal and a symbolic meaning. So I was wondering, which do you usually which do you usually consider first, and how do the two affect each other as the story progresses?
Oh, good question. I'll be honest with you, I don't always know what it is that I'm going to say. So in other words, the symbolism, the meaning comes out of the story. It's a textural thing for me. It's a felt thing, an emotional thing. If I know exactly beforehand what it is I'm going to say, I would feel like I'm in a little bit of a literary straitjacket, and I don't want to be. I'd be writing about an idea rather than an emotion or a journey or whatever it happens to be. So for me, the literal story itself unfolds, and then the symbolism or the metaphor or the meaning of it comes out of the story. And sometimes I as the author, don't even know what that means, and you guys come along and interpret it for me, which is wonderful.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Professor McCann. I'm Katie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Hi.
Good. Okay, so my question is, in Letters to a Young Writer, you stress the importance of a strong first line. What are some novels or stories you have read that stand out to you particularly because of their first lines? And are there any lines from novels or short stories that stand out for you?
Oh, sure. I mean, the first line is important to me for sure. I have a former student of mine whom you might have heard of. His name is Bill Sly, and he wrote a book called Redeployment, and he was a soldier in Iraq. And he had a very, very simple first line to his short story, Redeployment. And when I read it, I knew, based on these, well, the first couple of lines, that he was going to make it as a writer. But the first line is, "We shot dogs," right? And that doesn't sound amazing until, you know immediately, that you're in Iraq. You know immediately that there's a sort of guilt going on there. You know, and so I think it's, "We shot dogs." We called it Operation Scooby. We went out into the field, and basically the story unfolds about these soldiers shooting dogs that are eating the dead and the injured on the side of the street. I thought, wow, what a great first line. What a great first line. There's lots of great first lines, but Call Me Ishmael is an interesting first line. This is the saddest story ever told. That's a great first line. There are so many of them. I mean, you can't rely on the first line. It isn't everything, but it helps when you've got a really powerful opening like that. I hope you get good first lines. I'm sure you will. Sounds like you will.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you so much. Virginia
thank
has
you.
The next question.
Hello.
Hi, Virginia.
Hi. So my question is something that I thought a lot about while reading all of your works, but how or how much did you research to take on the perspectives of people that you don't share a background with, specifically female prostitutes in 1970s New York?
Okay, good question. Okay, here's what I did with Tilly. First of all, I went down to the library and I got out any books I could about prostitution in the early 70s. So anything I could find that was specific to that particular time. Then I looked at sociological studies and see if there's anything in there that I could find that would give me some sort of clue. Then I looked at wider studies of prostitution, not just in New York, but elsewhere. Then I looked at movies. Then I looked at pictures from Hunts Point in the Bronx at the time. Startling pictures of women out on the street, sometimes wearing nothing, sometimes wearing only swimsuits and high heels, and I began to form a picture in my mind of what it was going to be. Then I talked to people who lived in the Bronx in the 70s,
And then I talked to cops who'd been on the street. And then I tried to find women who'd been involved in the sex industry, and I couldn't find them. I did find ones who I couldn't find anybody who'd been around in the depths, because a lot of it died from heroin overdoses, so on. And also, they're not really, don't really want, if you're a grandmother now, and you don't really want to talk about your days as a hooker out on the streets in the Bronx. So I had to imagine it then. But you imagine them, so you gather all the material together, and it's almost like you concentrate it in your mind, and then you hope that you're going to be able to get a voice. Because the most important thing is to be able to get a voice out of all the information that's in your head. And so that's how I did. A lot of work goes into it. So it's not just sitting back and trying to imagine what it's like. It's getting out there and finding out about the world.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colm, it's about 11 o'clock and we have two questions, but if you don't have time, that's fine.
Say again?
It's about 11 o'clock now, and we have, I think, two more questions. Do you both want to ask you? Do you have time for one?
No, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Okay, thank you. This is Tillman.
Hi, Professor McCann.
Hi.
I'm Tillman. I'm Tillman.
How are you?
I'm not going to bother you with that question. I'm going to say I'm okay. And
okay.
Instead, I'm going to ask, what's your favorite color?
Ooh. Thank you. That's really interesting. I don't know what my favorite color is.
Okay, well, there we have it, folks.
Well, I'd say probably the first thing that sprung to mind was a very, very light September blue.
Okay. Well, I like that.
The sky is funny. Yeah.
I like that. That's my birth month. Okay.
Well, all right. What's your birthday?
September 14th.
September 14th. I have a good friend, and her birthday is September the 13th.
Yeah. You should send me a card.
I should do.
You should.
You're thinking of it. September 14th.
Yes. Just tell...
happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Just tell Dr. Kousadas. As a juvenile playwright, I'd be interested to know if you'd ever like to see your characters, such as Tilly, she was my favorite, from Let the Great World Spin in a play, because I know that you had another book published that went into playwright, and I forgot what it was called, but it only ran for 6 weeks, and you didn't like it?
Yeah, and... I am the person adapting Zoli right now as a play. She's an Irish traveler woman, so in other words, like Jared would call her gypsy, but she's adapting my book Zoli right now for stage. So the answer is yes. Be careful about calling yourself a juvenile playwright, by the way. You don't want to be a juvenile playwright because you don't want that to become a descriptive term. You're a playwright. You just say, I'm a playwright. And then if people ask you, you say, I'm a playwright for young people, because you don't want juvenile to be the descriptor, right?
Well, I say juvenile because I don't know if that's where I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the answer to your question is, absolutely. So, I'm always interested in people expanding the form of characters, and having the world, having the work live in another time and another place. So sounds great to me.
Great, thank you so much, Professor McCann. Jada has the last question for you.
Okay, thanks so much.
Good morning, Professor. Thank you for spending this time with the class. I know you're really busy. My question is, after the national recognition of Let the Great World Spin, how has the success of the book imprinted or evolved your writing style and influenced your perspective now in your writing process?
Well, I wish I could say that, the success of it or the recognition didn't change me at all. In fact, I hope that's the true answer. But the fact of the matter is that when you get that sort of recognition, it does put a little pressure on you
in different ways. In some ways, some people expect you to do the same sort of thing again, and that's what I don't want to do. I don't want to write the same sort of book over and over and over again. I want to continually evolve. And so it puts a little pressure on your evolution as a person, and you have to be disciplined enough to keep doing what it is that you want to do. And it also puts a little pressure on the idea of failure, and you don't want to fail as much because there's much more at stake. It's more of a public failure than a small one. But as you know, I write a lot in Letters to a Young Writer, is that you have to embrace failure. The failure is good, the failure is good. But unless you're failing, you're not really living. The expectation there is that you're going to, you're putting yourself out just a little bit more. So this is the novel I'm currently working on, and is a very, very, very ambitious a different sort of project, which is sort of bound to failure. That's about the Middle East, and it's a very different territory for me. And I know that I'm under a bit of pressure with it, but that's okay. And so I have to also enjoy the fruits of the success and know that I get a chance to talk to people like you guys, and that's a big privilege for me. I'm lucky because the vast majority of writers do not get the opportunities that I get. So I feel lucky in overall, and happy that I get a chance to get my work out into the world.
Jada, you spent some time in New York City this summer, didn't you?
Yeah.
Tell them a little bit about what you did. Jada was spent a lot of time in this city. This summer.
Well, usually I just go to visit and spend time with family, but I also just get a lot of inspiration from going to different events and things as far as a writer and a designer. But I took a critical writing class at Princeton University this summer as well, and that's changed my perspective a lot and just structuring everything that I write.
Jada is editor of our online newspaper, which we're just starting to get going, and Patrick is editing the newspaper Applause, which I think you're probably familiar with, and a few of the members in Taylor are also on the staff, so that we're hoping for big things with our newspaper. We're already putting our first issue out, thanks to them, on Friday, which is earlier than we ever have, but we've got a lot of good kids in this class, and it's off to a good start.
That's great. Well, then, great question.
Thank you. This has been awesome. And good luck with the book. We can't wait. And thanks for cluing us into a little bit. At least we know the title and a little bit about it. And we'll look forward to it.
You're the only guys who know the title. So.
Yeah, all right. We won't let it out. Thank you so much for doing this for us. And I hope
let's talk soon.
Yeah, enjoy the rest of your day. And say hello to everybody in your family.
Much.
Thank you, Colin. Talk to you soon.
All right, cheers, guys.
All right, cheers.
Bye.
Good job, guys.